trust that those who had were benefiting not from their misuse of others, but because of their productive labor. This meant admiration for success rather than resentment and envy, and also meant, in the main, that those who were striving for and attaining success had been acting in good faith. This outlook is something that arguably characterizes the attitude of the individual citizen of the United States, first and foremost, although it can also be seen to a greater or lesser degree across the economically successful countries of the world. Thus, our collective partial defeat of death is a consequence most fundamentally of a sustained and successful moral endeavor, and only a secondary result of the technological miracles that such reorientation, or proper orientation, makes possible. This begs a question. If we all acted in a manner that would best enable us to optimize our exploration, our exchange of information, best enable us to rely on one another and therefore to cooperate without doubt, without unnecessary obstacle or stumbling block, what, if any, problems would remain beyond our capacity to solve? Thus, the questions remain. How much is mortal suffering, and even death itself, a consequence of the inexorable effects of entropy and disorder, say, intrinsic to the existential situation of man as a material organism? And how much is it due to the moral failings that destabilize and corrupt our collective enterprises and make each of us much less than we could otherwise be? And if none of that fundamentally changes the fact of death itself, is it not still the case, as noted earlier, that full commitment to the upward aim that is adventure takes the sting out of painful limitation and mortality? This, too, is a form of triumph over death and hell. What all this means is that the terrors and boundaries of life can be overcome to a finely indeterminate degree, practically, in that suffering, physical degeneration, and even death itself can be limited and life abundant, promoted, and extended, psychologically, in that the responsible and meaningful pursuit of genuine adventure can sustain and motivate even in the midst of the worst conceivable privations. The Promised Land should therefore not so much be conceptualized as a place journeyed to geographically, although it is also that, as a place established through sustained moral striving, individual and collective. After the Israelites have organized themselves psychologically, shedding, at least in part, their unwillingness to adopt responsibility, their fractious squabbling, their faithlessness and false nostalgia for the days of tyranny, after they have as well organized themselves socially in accordance with the principle of subsidiarity, they are now advanced enough to see the Promised Land itself on the horizon. They therefore send scouts to provide a detailed survey of the territory. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Send thou men, that they may search the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel. Of every tribe of their fathers shall ye send a man, everyone a ruler among them. Numbers 13:1. The true leaders of men are visionaries. It is inevitable that they will be the surveyors of new territory, as that is the role of the prophet who can see the proper path forward with untrammeled vision and moral clarity. The scouts return with a report of the great potential that is waiting there, warning simultaneously that the problems that remain to be solved, including the fact of the current inhabitants, still loom large. And they returned from searching of the land after 40 days. And they went and came to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation of the children of Israel, unto the wilderness of Paran to Kadesh, and brought back word unto them and unto all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told him and said, We came unto the land whither thou sentest, and surely it floweth with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it. Nevertheless, the people be strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled and very great. Numbers 13:25-28. As we move into the future, we encounter the endless spirits of opposition that dwell there. These are all too often the descendants of Cain, the prideful and resentful presumptions and habits of self and other that will make of that future nothing but the repetition of the sins and errors of the past. Those are the inhabitants that have to be overcome. Whatever proves counterproductive or insufficiently upward aiming there must be cleared out or converted for the promise to be truly realized. This is another example of the separation of wheat from chaff, or the operation of the swift sword that cuts and burns, that comprises the eternal battle between evil and good, or even between good and better. Movement forward into the better future is a daunting task. Many such potential promised lands are already occupied by the Canaanites, who failed at the task, something both indicative of the difficulty and part of it. It is for such reasons that the majority of the scouts prove faithless and pessimistic in the face of the challenges that remain. And Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it. But the men that went up with him said, We be not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. And they brought up an evil report of the land which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, The land through which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof. And all the people that we saw in it are men of a great stature. And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight. Numbers 13:30-33. This caution is best read as a failure of leadership, rather than as an honest accounting of the trials and tribulations that still confront the Israelites. God's chosen people have been continually enjoined to manifest faith in the fact that what is truly moral will prevail. God has made it clear that his people, if they maintain the true covenant, will prevail even against apparently insuperable odds. The more timorous leaders nonetheless exaggerate the danger still to come, falsely and manipulatively portraying their remaining opponents as giants, contrasting them with their comparatively insect-like selves. These are hardly the actions of men capable of taking the next steps forward or of motivating others to do so. They are instead the actions of those who have renounced the responsibility and burden and foregone the attendant redemptive meaning of authentic pathfinding. They deliver the words that terrify and demoralize, instead of fortifying and renewing. It is hard not to nurture the suspicion as well that this is done for underground reasons. People can be frightened into precisely the submission that both keeps them slaves and enables the up-and-coming would-be tyrants, the very scouts who doomsay. What might we distill from this account in our modern time? In the face of the continually dire and dangerously authoritarian cautions about the future that flood both the airwaves and our consciousness, the planet has too many people on it. The apocalypse is nigh. Perhaps we should beware the faithlessness of those constantly crying that the sky is about to fall while we attempt in good faith to make our way forward. It is a truism that the eternal usurper sows doubt and terror to aid his attempts to demoralize, seduce, and obtain power. Why demoralize? Because doubt about the future produces anxiety and destroys hope. Why seduce? A strategy that works so well with demoralization. Not least because terror and its consequent anxiety and hopelessness is simultaneously an invitation to abandon responsibility and regress to the infantile pleasures of immediate gratification. What's the point? Is a question that logically precedes a certain self-serving conclusion. Everything is hopeless. It is time to live like there's no tomorrow. Shades of the faithless and orgiastic worship of the golden calf. That enticement to slavish hedonism is part and parcel of the degeneration of the voluntarily subsidiary society into the authoritarian polarity of slave and tyrant. The demoralizing rumors spread like wildfire. The people yet again cry piteously, murmuring against Moses and against Aaron, Numbers 14:1, bemoaning even the fact that they are still alive, lamenting that they have come so far only to face defeat. Would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God we had died in this wilderness? And wherefore hath the Lord brought us into this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return unto Egypt? Numbers 14:2-3. Caleb and a few others attempt to restore their spirits, but the Israelites have embraced panic so thoroughly that they turn against the faithful and forthright optimists, the deniers of the impending apocalypse, and stone them. When a people have fallen into the grip of the lie that produces terror, those who tell the truth, the optimistic truth, become regarded as veritable enemies. This is a state that makes hope itself a crime. That is a state very close to hell. It may come as no surprise by this point that none of this pleases God. He tells Moses that he really has had enough and is tired of being called on to demonstrate his redemptive power. He determines, therefore, to disinherit the Israelites, to smite them with a good batch of pestilence, and to begin again with Moses, as he had threatened to do before, and as he actually did in the case of Noah. Moses, who is nothing if not long-suffering, bargains with God, pleading for him to once again forgive his sinful followers and to continue providing for them what has been promised in spite of their faithlessness, noting that failure to do so will damage his holy reputation. Numbers 14:15, reminding him, perhaps, that he had famously agreed to permanently forego such extreme measures, with the placement of the rainbow, for example, in Genesis 9:8-17. God agrees to be good, so to speak, but not to completely forego his vengeance. All those who have decided to look away, turn tail, and run are barred from entry into the promised land. Those who maintain faith, even in the face of the doubt so thoroughly sowed by the schemers and the cowards, are, by contrast, invited forward. And the Lord said, I have pardoned according to thy word, but as truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles, which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have tempted me now these 10 times, and have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoked me see it. but my servant Caleb, because he had another spirit with him and hath followed me fully. Him will I bring into the land whereinto he went, and his seed shall possess it. Numbers 14, 20 to 24. Furthermore, the faithless scouts of the future are struck by a devastating plague, Numbers 14, 36 to 37, leaving live among them only Caleb and Joshua, who maintained their optimism as they explored and reported. This is yet another example of the action of the Logos, of the separation of wheat from chaff and sheep from goats, of the work of the terrible, swift, and burning sword. The hypothetical giants of Canaan are tantamount to the monstrous cherubim who wields such a blade. The fact of the presence of those formidable foes, even if imaginary, serves to differentiate the wheat from the tares or chaff and the lambs from the goats. In this manner, the obstacles and enemies in the path, the thistles and the thorns of the fallen world, Genesis 3:18, do the work of separating that which is worthy from that which is not. Only what is truly faithful and courageous will enter the promised land, as indicated previously. How could it be otherwise and still be that perfect land? Your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and all that were numbered of you, according to your whole number, from 20 years old and upward, which have murmured against me. Doubtless ye shall not come into the land, concerning which I swear to make you dwell therein, save Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. Numbers 14, 29 to 30. The degradation to carcass begins with the faithless leaders and spreaders of demoralizing rumors themselves. Even those men that did bring up the evil report upon the land died by the plague before the Lord. Numbers 14, 37. Hopelessness and terror can become exactly that plague. This forbidding of movement forward and delivery of death is followed immediately by a terrible military defeat, suffered at the hands of the very Amalekites the Israelites imagined to be giants. Moses warns them explicitly that they are in no shape to battle, for the Amalekites and the Canaanites are there before you, and ye shall fall by the sword, because you are turned away from the Lord. Therefore the Lord will not be with you. Numbers 14, 43. Insisting that forward movement into the future is impossible, insisting that the promised land is uninhabitable and poisoned, regardless of all moral effort, demoralizing with the dissemination of such a negative vision, punishing those who dare say anything heartening, optimistic, and requiring responsible and courageous conduct. None of this is acceptable to the spirit inhabiting the great stories of the Old Testament. God's punishment for such betrayal is harsh, but realistic. There is no possible way for a people who have lost faith to reach their proper destination. Before the plague, the barring of the pathway forward, and the defeat in battle, a mere 4 men remained faithful in all the multitude of Israel: Moses, Aaron, Caleb, and Joshua. These 4 were, furthermore, the very men upon whom the wrath of the mob turned, slashes of Sodom prior to God's destruction of that city, Genesis 19. It is an eternal truth that those who practice genuine faith in the presence of the cowardice and derisive fatalism of the mob will be persecuted for their temerity rather than merely ignored. This is part of the pattern of destruction of the ideal, characteristic of the descendants of Cain. None of this excuses failure to stand up and be counted when the time comes. In the aftermath of this mass rejection of the covenant, as well as God's warning and punishment and Moses' successful intercession, the laws are once again reviewed, particularly those pertaining to sacrifice and the keeping of the Sabbath, Numbers 15. This is not the only manner in which the pathetic dissatisfaction and murmuring of the Israelites is dealt with. God also hands down, at the same time, a seemingly minor instruction. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and bid them that they make them fringes in the borders of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of the borders a riband of blue. Numbers 15, 37 to 38. Like so many of the apparently arbitrary rules put forward in the biblical narrative, God's order follows a broader pattern of injunction, which in turn reflects something very deep about the structure of reality itself, at least insofar as reality is perceived or experienced reality. This commandment, with regard to clothing, is a further proclamation about the necessary dynamic and stabilizing relationship of the center or ideal to the marginal or experimental. The pattern of injunction, there is to be a center and a fringe, and both are to be recognized and marked, is also evident in the commands for land ownership and harvesting. And when ye reap the harvest of your land, thou shalt not wholly reap the corners of thy field, neither shalt thou gather the gleanings of thy harvest. And thou shalt not glean thy vineyard, neither shalt thou gather every grape of thy vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and stranger. I am the Lord your God. Leviticus 19, 9 to 10. The law immediately preceding this one deals with the nature of proper sacrifice. The one immediately following forbids theft, false dealing, and deception. Thus, it is implied that allowance for the margin or fringe is akin to the appropriate sacrificial offering and something antithetical in its spirit to thievery. If you own something, which means that you have it and others do not, it is perhaps necessary to solve your own conscience properly, to propitiate the potential anger of the community, to practice a generous productivity, to be liberal at the margins. That is, to not be too exacting and mean where the boundaries are not clear, to better allow for what has not yet been integrated into the social order and cannot easily thrive in its place. If that generosity is provided, the marginal can exist without undue suffering, and perhaps without generating a counterproductive resentment against what is inevitably and sometimes even necessarily central. This means that success might be possible without it being equated, however rightly or falsely, with theft. It means that an individual can both rise and be acclaimed in that rise instead of being regarded as the one who exploited or climbed uphill on the backs of others. This protects both the striving individual and society from descent into the pathological victim-victimizer dynamic represented archetypally in the account of Cain and Abel. Finally, the provision of some generous but wise allowance to the excluded or marginalized might aid in their valid incorporation or movement upward into the center. This means more of the competence characterizing every individual could be used productively, and it means that the community expands and stabilizes. The necessity for this balance between ideal and fringe is further illustrated in the book of Ruth. Ruth is a Moabite woman and therefore an outsider who initially marries an Israelite man named Mahlon. Her husband dies, as does his brother, leaving Ruth widowed and alone. Naomi, her mother-in-law, suggests that Ruth return to her own people to start her life again. Instead, she proclaims her loyalty and willingness to serve and sojourns with Naomi to initiate and accept a life of poverty in Bethlehem. And Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee, for whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me." Ruth 1, 16 to 17. Well, in Bethlehem, she gleans in the fields of Boaz, a well-to-do landowner. Impressed by her loyalty and kindness, he marries her. The couple has a son, Obed, who becomes the grandfather of King David. It is in this manner that Ruth, gathered from the fringe to the middle or even ideal, then comes to play a crucial role in the unfolding destiny of the Israelites. The margin has value, just like the center. Without a center, nothing can hold. Without the margins, however, there is no possibility for experimentation. There is nowhere for the new ideas that might at some point prove central or crucial to the maintenance of what is now central to manifest themselves. The balance between these two, stability or ideal, the stake in the ground that establishes habitable territory and even conception, mutability or experiment, the variation that allows for exploration and necessary change, is evident even at the most profound and fundamental levels of biological existence, as intimated earlier. It is a truism that mutation is random and that the variation on which adaptive transformation depends, in tandem, of course, with selection, both natural and sexual, is a consequence of this random mutation. This truism turns out to be much less than strictly true, however. It is the case that the process of mutation is genuinely random in at least some of its aspects, depending as it does, for example, on the absolutely unpredictable effects of so-called cosmic rays on DNA itself. But DNA is very good at repairing itself. This turns out to be especially the case when the genes that have been subject to transformational damage are crucial to the production of forms and function that would compromise survival or reproductive fitness if damaged. In such cases, the repair processes function with essentially perfect accuracy. Variation is allowed, by contrast, on the fringe, with regard to functions that are not crucial. So even in the molecular domain on which life depends, there is conservation of the center with allowable experimentation on the margin or the fringe. This is a truly revolutionary finding, transforming as it does our understanding of the hypothetically random nature of evolution. If the center is conserved, a cross-mutational transformation, the progression forward is hardly random, even at the level of the mutation itself. This is particularly true, given that selection itself is anything but random, especially when it is of the highly choosy sexual variety, which allows for the discriminating effect of conscious choice itself on evolutionary progress. It is in the dynamism between center and fringe that true stability, the metastability that can adapt to change with the least possible disruption, is forever negotiated. This is the dynamism indicated by the interactions of the staff and serpent that make up Moses' magical rod of living tradition. That metastability is guaranteed by respect for the logos that transforms creative thought, free speech, exploration, and play, and its crystallization into the fatherly tradition that stabilizes, something akin to the law and the prophets, it may seem an odd paradox that the Israelites are asked specifically to look upon the outer edge to remember God. And it shall be unto you for a fringe, that ye may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them, and that ye seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which ye use to go a whoring, that ye may remember and do all my commandments and be holy unto your God. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God. Numbers 15, 39 to 41. Is it too much of a stretch to assume that it is in the very act of considering the fringe that the wisdom of the center is remembered? When dealing with clinical clients unhappy in their marriage and tempted toward misbehavior, such as an affair, perhaps with that opportunity immediately at hand, I always counseled them to think it through. What are you doing when you deviate from the vows of your marriage? Are you delivering to your mistress all the attention properly devoted to your wife, without requiring her to share any of the true responsibilities of your life and perhaps hers? Are you pretending that this will be all benefit and no cost? Are you discounting the terrible and tearful conversations to come, the betrayal, the effect on your children, the inevitable courtroom confrontations and costs? Are you assuming that this new paramour will somehow magically overlook all the faults you carry personally that have compromised your marriage? Are you, in other words, refusing to look at the fringe and thereby forgetting the vital importance of the center? Could it not be then that it is precisely in the deepest consideration of the true nature of the fringe, including its genuine attractions and possibilities, as well as its inescapable dangers, that what is important is most profoundly conceptualized, clarified, and remembered? The fool is there in part to remind us of the wise, the bearer of tragedy, to highlight the comedy of the victor, the villain to clarify the role of the hero. The margin in its proper place signifies the necessity and value of the center. Out of place, attempting to usurp the center, it is an agent of chaos, and the very chaos that destroys the marginal itself first due to its comparative instability and fragility. The monstrous and the misfits have their place, but it is not and cannot be the center. Their placement there, even when requested, poses more of a risk to them, to say it again, than to those who occupy the hypothetically challenged but fundamentally more stable ideal or tradition. Moses soon thereafter addresses yet another challenge to his leadership, Numbers 16. This time, the rebellion appears in the form of an egalitarian populism. Korah, a member of the Levite priestly caste, emerges as a challenger, saying to Moses and Aaron, "Ye take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them. Wherefore ye then lift ye up yourselves among the congregation of the Lord." Numbers 16:3. This objection is reiterated later when Moses reproaches Korah, pointing out that God himself has assigned differentiated responsibility for leadership. "Seemeth it but a small thing unto you that the God of Israel hath separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself to do the service of the tabernacle of the Lord and to stand before the congregation to minister unto them? And he hath brought thee near to him and all thy brethren, the sons of Levi, with thee. And seek ye the priesthood also? For which cause both thou and all thy company are gathered together against the Lord. And what is Aaron that ye murmur against him? Numbers 16, 9 to 11. This narrative sequence makes perfect sense, following as it does the presentation of the fringe-center dynamic. The revolutionary impulse of Korah is precisely the marginal attempting to usurp the center. The would-be rebels claim that the current structure of authority is nothing but the machinations of the will to power and self-gratification, claiming that all the work of Moses and Aaron was naked self-interest. This is also a variant of the victim-victimizer narrative, or a representation of the story of the hostile brothers, with the claim of oppression being used by the complainants to justify their adoption of power. Moses' genuine attempt to reconcile is rejected forthwith. Why? The rebels do not want peace. They want to invert the order they attribute to nothing but power and to take all the positions of hypothetical dominance and force for themselves. It is the rare revolutionary indeed who has any other motivation, all compassionate protestations to the contrary. We will not come up. Is it a small thing that thou hast brought us up out of a land that floweth with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, except thou make thyself altogether a prince over us? Moreover, thou hast not brought us into a land that floweth with milk and honey, or given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Wilt thou put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. Numbers 16, 12 to 14. Moses is facing foes who claim the moral upper hand, maintaining that they act on behalf of the people and are therefore justified in their attempts to usurp doing what they are doing for the victimized others. Moses must therefore face down a series of accusations that are, on the face of it, potentially valid. How is it that he, or anyone he leads, can be sure that his leadership is not merely the result of his own grandiosity, narcissism, desire for power, privilege — he was a son of the Pharaoh — and corruption? In large part, because his own conscience remains clear on the matter. Their attempts to manipulate him fall flat. And Moses was very wroth and said unto the Lord, "Respect not thou their offering. I have not taken one ass from them, neither have I hurt one of them." Numbers 16:15. The true leader, who embodies the Spirit of God, the law, and tradition, who nonetheless speaks with a prophetic voice, can remain sanguine in the face of even the most adversarial accusations as a direct result of that fidelity and humble openness to revelation. The good man has nothing to hide, has already genuinely sacrificed his narrow and hedonistic self-interest to the transcendent good. He has abided by the dictates of his conscience and faithfully followed the voice of his calling, and can trust himself as anyone might trust another who acts honestly and consistently, regardless of situation or temptation. In consequence, he is immune to the imputation of wrongdoing, and not because he is blind to his own fault or sin. Indeed, as a genuine devotee of sacrificial conduct and transformational progress, he is constantly attending to his own shortcomings. This means that the man who, like Noah, is wise in his generations and who walks with God, Genesis 6:9, can stand naked, upright, and without shame in the very face of the moralizing mob and stare them down. It is also that capacity for unself-conscious and therefore unashamed attention, speech, and conduct that lends him credence and charisma as a leader. Moses and those who stand with him separate themselves from Korah and the remainder of the rebels, expressing sorrow for what they believe now to be inevitable. The terrible consequences of Korah's deceptive rebellion immediately make themselves manifest. And it came to pass, as he had made an end of speaking all these words, that the ground clave asunder that was under them, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up, and their houses, and all the men that appertained unto Korah, and all their goods. They and all that appertained to them went down alive into the pit, and the earth closed upon them, and they perished from among the congregation. Numbers 16:31-33. When the marginal claims the right to be central, it is not the center that typically collapses into destruction, but the unrighteous usurpers themselves. This is why the excess and usually false pity for those who inhabit the outer darkness of the world, that, remember, is the eternal sin of Eve, is so inexcusable. The very targets of that indiscriminate and hypothetically merciful judgment will be the first to be demolished by its consequences. The world is not destroyed in its totality when the toddler is encouraged by an excess of care to maintain his infancy, although the holy babe, who is world redeemer in disguise, may well be threatened. The world is likewise very unlikely to rearrange itself to adapt to the whims of the now misbehaving child, then adolescent or adult. It is instead the individual so pampered and falsely encouraged who is sorely threatened and damaged. It is instead the integrity, maturity of psyche, opportunity for true adventure and hope for upward development that would otherwise characterize that child that is put at risk by the devouring mother. There is more yet to the story of Korah's revolution, failure, and destruction, and that is the indication that the proper subsidiary structure of responsibility established by God through Moses is not to be overthrown by a false egalitarianism. Moses and Aaron, and to a lesser degree, the leaders of the specific tribes of Israel and the common people themselves, have done the genuine work and therefore acquired the authority and competence necessary to maintain order and specify the way forward. They have sufficiently maintained their covenant with what is highest and continued their upward aiming striving away from tyranny and slavery through the trials of the desert and toward the promised land. That is not a pattern to be casually undone by usurpers claiming righteous revolution in the name of the easily manipulated and resentful mob of the fringe. Such things never change. Even after all this punishment is meted out to the rebels, and even though it follows the plague, death, and military defeat that was not so long before visited on those who had the temerity to lose faith and to complain, the Israelites continue to proclaim their grievances against God, Moses, and Aaron. The sojourn of this once again unhappy people thus continues into the desert of Zin, another desert following a bout of faithlessness and rebellion, where they run short of water and begin even more loudly to chide and murmur. Their two leaders, prophet and political voice, nonetheless plead the case of the desperate people before God. The divine voice in turn instructs Moses very specifically to speak in the presence of his people to the hard stones of the desert land and invite them to bring forth the life-giving liquid. Moses and Aaron depart and gather the Israelites together as instructed, before the rock. Numbers 20:10. Moses does not employ his words in invitation, however, as he has been explicitly told to do. Instead, the great and erstwhile devotee of God, delivers the rock two solid blows with his staff. This use of force and compulsion, this unnecessary display of power, displeases God immensely. So much so that it is easy to regard what comes next as incomprehensibly harsh. God denies his disobedient prophet entrance into the promised land itself, despite the decades he has spent in the service of the people and the divine. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron, because ye believed me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore ye shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. Numbers 20:12. Aaron is barred as well, perhaps because he was there when the initial instructions were delivered and did not act to ensure they were undertaken in the proper spirit. Did his conscience bother the brother of the prophet when he was apprised, if he was, of Moses' intentions? Or did Aaron believe, so conveniently and in his political manner, that a little show of power might have been just the thing to keep a fractious people in check? Moses' staff is the rod of tradition and order. Misused, it easily becomes the cudgel of compulsion and power. A stout stick can point in an inviting direction or beat a reluctant or involuntary traveler into submission. It depends on the aim, will, and temptation of he who wields it. Moses brandishes his staff with undue force, using stick when carrot is called for, when called for by God himself. He does so twice as well, so there is no mistaking his intent. Further, both he and Aaron indicate directly that it is the two of them performing the redemptive act, instead of explicitly and in all due humility laying the glory at the feet of God. Moses says directly, "Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock?" Numbers 20:10. Both men are very experienced at this point and stand at the very threshold of their ultimate goal. It is at such moments when the temptation to become arrogant arguably looms largest, and when it might well have the most damning and degrading consequences. At this crucial moment, right on the very cusp of his potentially highest success, right when he most truly has the opportunity to become the new man in the new world that he has been constantly called to be, Moses succumbs, as does his brother, to the spirit of the prideful usurper, taking to himself, in the Luciferian manner, the right to establish the moral order. The great leader has got too big for his britches, and Aaron stays in lockstep. This is a psychological and social catastrophe, given the size of the stakes currently in question. It might still be objected. Surely, Moses and his brother have earned the right to be forgiven a momentary lapse of faith and reason, if anyone has ever earned that right. Apparently not, at least in the judgment of what is truly and forever sovereign. Is it so unreasonable to assume that the privilege of leadership must necessarily be attended by the requirement for the utmost care in moral conduct, particularly in matters serious enough to provoke divine intercession? Is that not particularly true when the goal is to avoid establishing a new tyranny and founding instead the eternal promised land? This is a high order of moral enterprise, which carries with it an equally high level of demand in relationship to conduct. It was apparently necessary for Moses to have completely sacrificed his temptation to wield force to manage the next step in his personal transformation and as leader of his people. Because he failed to do so, he cannot progress and falls prey, so to speak, to the sword of judgment. It seems that disobedience in any matters involving the very water of life, conjoined with careless and haughty default to force and fear, is a conjoint sin of sufficient magnitude to bar even leaders who have otherwise been the best of men from the privilege of mounting the final foray into the reestablished Garden of Eden or the heavenly kingdom. The punishment for Aaron, the political arm, is the ultimate barring of the way forward. Aaron is stripped of his garments of authority, his very identity as earthly leader, and dies. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron in Mount Hor, by the coast of the land of Edom, saying, Aaron shall be gathered unto his people, for he shall not enter into the land which I have given unto the children of Israel, because ye rebelled against my word at the water of Meribah. Take Aaron and Eleazar his son, and bring them up unto Mount Hor, and strip Aaron of his garments, and put them upon Eleazar his son. And Aaron shall be gathered unto his people, and shall die there. And Moses did as the Lord commanded, and they went up into Mount Hor in the sight of all the congregation. And Moses stripped Aaron of his garments and put them upon Eleazar his son. And Aaron died there in the top of the mount, and Moses and Eleazar came down from the mount. And when all the congregation saw that Aaron was dead, they mourned for Aaron 30 days, even all the house of Israel. Numbers 20, 23 to 29. This is truly a cautionary tale. If men such as Moses and Aaron are unworthy to take that final step, who then can be saved? It is only Joshua and Caleb who retain faith alongside Moses and Aaron, despite the danger of Canaan, real or imagined, and the cowardly and fear-mongering reports of the scouts sent to the promised land, Numbers 13 to 14. Joshua shares a name very tightly associated with the Christian Savior himself. Both appellations are variants of Yeshua, which means salvation. The longer variant, Yehoshua, means Yahweh saves. It is this Joshua who takes the reins of leadership from Moses, guiding the Israelites along the final step of their journey. Christians have traditionally read this story at a higher level of abstraction, presuming that redemption itself is dependent on what Christ embodies, incarnates, or represents, superseding the exemplary pattern of spirit, even of the leadership of Moses, and presuming that this necessity is foreshadowed by the manner in which the Israelite sojourn concludes. Aaron dies, as God has indicated, outside the land given unto the children of Israel, Numbers 20, 24. The political, corrupted by pride and power, can in no wise be the spirit that leads the way to paradise, and this, regardless of its history of guidance and triumph. Numbers continues with another round of faithlessness, rumor-mongering, and irresponsible rebellion on the part of the Israelites, a story that also foreshadows the story of Christ in a nigh miraculously deep manner. It is impossible to imagine how the layers of concordance and cross-reference characteristic of this closing story could possibly have been crafted. The meaning of the story is almost self-evident once revealed, but so remarkably subtle, sophisticated, and implicit prior to that revelation. How could such a thing be possible, particularly given the millennia that transpire between the narrative setup, so to speak, and the denouement of the story? Who could possibly manage such a feat of storytelling genius? The only credible secular explanation for the attainment of the profound characterization and representation we will soon lay bare is the operation of something equivalent to the collective unconscious of mankind, as formulated by C.G. Jung and the thinkers of his school. The imagination of the race, writ large. First, puzzling out the central nature of adaptation in a process of trial and error. Then, representing the results of that painful process in abstracted narrative. Finally, the weaving together and editing of that narrative over centuries, the removal of internal contradiction, the crafting of the most compelling meta-story conceivable. Separating that process from divine revelation itself appears practically impossible. Either explanation appears equally implausible and unlikely. Both might best be regarded as variants of the same thing. One viewed, in the case of the unconscious, from the bottom up, the other, in the case of divine revelation, from the top down. In either case, the miracle remains. After the events in the desert of Zin, the Israelites continue what by now must be feeling like their interminable journey forward. They travel from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom, Numbers 21:4. Once again, the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way, Numbers 21:4. Petulant and peevish, as is so often the case, they rail against the privations they are experiencing, expressing dissatisfaction with the heavenly fare that makes up their provisioning. And the people spake against God and against Moses, "Wherefore have ye brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water, and our soul loatheth this light bread." Numbers 21:5. It is perhaps understandable that the Israelites are frustrated with the lightness of their fare. For decades they have wandered with little more than faith and hope to guide them, and that is certainly the airiest of foods. Nonetheless, the return to aggrieved victimhood on the part of his people does not please God. This time, however, he takes a different tack in response to their inconstancy. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. Numbers 21:6. This seems heavy-handed, much as the punishment meted out to Moses and Aaron is arguably heavy-handed, to say nothing of the ongoing smiting of faithless Israelites as well as their enemies. The poor Israelites are clearly thinking, and with some reason, tyranny and slavery, then decades of lost wandering, desert and chaos. It is already all too much. And now we have to put up with poisonous snakes biting us because, apparently, the desert wasteland was somehow not burdensome enough. It is easy to feel sympathy for their plight, and perhaps appropriately so, out of tyranny into the endless wasteland. This is no laughing matter. The poisonous snakes can be reasonably apprehended as a bridge too far. Is there another interpretation, more favorable to God? Certainly, and it is another unbearable truth. There is no pit of hell so deep that something more bottomless could not yet be revealed, brought about by some faithless, treacherous, and craven act or omission. This is true for individual and society alike. The abyss is truly bottomless. If you are visited by misfortune, however just or unjust, and you maintain your resolution, you at least have the consolation of your courage and faith to accompany the misery visited upon you. If you lose hope, turning instead to the path indicated by the spirit of resentment, arrogance, and deceit, the hell you have already suffered, no matter how bad it is, will be nothing compared to the hell you will bring about. Thus arrive the snakes, fiery and poisonous, even in the midst of the most desiccated, vast, and harsh of deserts. It is not even so much a punishment as an inevitability. There is no situation so terrible that some stupid son of a bitch cannot make yet worse. And that means you and me. After suffering from sufficient biting to think again, or at least to wish the snakes away, the Israelites repent and come to Moses, saying, "We have spoken against the Lord and against thee. Pray unto the Lord that he take away the serpents from us." And Moses prayed for the people. Numbers 21:7. One of two very predictable and straightforward outcomes appears likely. God could refuse and strike down the wayward rebels. Alternatively, he could show some mercy and get rid of the snakes, which were, after all, his creation. That is not what happens. Instead, God instructs Moses, "Make thee a fiery serpent and set it upon a pole." Numbers 21:8. The interplay of pole, rod, staff, and serpent has been indicated on multiple occasions by this time in various forms. There is the snake in the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, Genesis 3. There is the staff of Moses, which can transform itself into a serpent and into the serpent that can devour all other rods and serpents. That fiery reptile is chaos itself, the unknown itself in all its predatory manifestations, in all its dragon-like combination of cat, snake, bird, and fire, the ancient foes of man and other primates, in all its capacity to shed its skin and be reborn. Perhaps it might be imagined that paradise is the place where all the snakes have been vanquished, the place that is eternally secure and safe. But what of challenge, or adventure, or the promise of something new? Perhaps it is better to learn to handle snakes than to rid the world of snakes. Do those who love their children protect them from all danger, or encourage them to become contenders, veritable slayers of dragons? Whenever we approve of the steps that a diligent and focused child is taking toward competence and maturity rather than continued infantile dependence, we take the latter path rather than the former. This is the quest that is, of course, represented in what might well be the most fundamental of all the stories of mankind, that of the dragon fight. First detailed in written form in the Mesopotamian epic Enuma Elish, the battle with the immortal serpent is re-represented constantly in literature, both ancient and modern. Its basic hypothesis, so to speak, the moral that it conveys, is that voluntary confrontation with what is most frightening and repellent provides the riches that never cease, the gold hoarded by the dragon, the grateful and now willing virgins freed from the dragon's lair and profoundly and rightly impressed by their rescuer. It is precisely to indicate and encourage this brave response that God does not banish the snakes. He decides, instead, to fortify and strengthen the Israelites themselves, as a good father would be wont to do. After the serpent is cast and set upon the rod or staff of tradition, he calls on his wayward people to gaze upon that conjoint presence of order and chaos, and to do so voluntarily in good faith. And the Lord said to Moses, "Make thee a fiery serpent and set it upon a pole. And it shall come to pass that everyone that is bitten, when he looketh upon it, shall live." And Moses made a serpent of brass and put it upon a pole. And it came to pass that if a serpent had bitten any man when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. Numbers 21:8-9. when even neurotic, dependent, and avoidant individuals practice the countervailing strategy of approach and observe themselves doing so successfully, they master the thing or situation to which they have approached. In doing so, they also update and expand their self-conceptualizations, viewing themselves increasingly as people who can rather than people who cannot. Reaching this generalized conclusion changes their behavior, and not just their behavior in the face of a particular stimulus, but to the entire class of stimuli they fear. This means that their character transforms. There is little difference between such change and learning itself. The experiences that transform us, even in their micro manifestations, always occur on the edge, in the face of the unknown, in the zone of proximal development, in the realm of the deep meaning that sustains and motivates, that exists on the border between yin and yang. In consequence of practicing the voluntary approach and exploration that transforms, the once timid become at least partial incarnations of the dragon slayer. This is a much more salutary and appropriate response, considering the further reaches of human nature, than cowering timorously and ashamed in the village cellar while the winged serpent spreads fire and destruction. The practitioners of such approach become those who take active steps, alternatively conceptualized, to free themselves from the belly of the beast that devoured them when they ran and tried to hide, become those in yet another narrative variant who truly confront tyranny and escape from slavery. The Israelites gaze on the snake to regain their faith, to become braver, to become less afraid and more willing to continue into the desert despite the snakes, because they now regard themselves as those who can look upon the poisonous and paralyzing and prevail. Thus, emboldened by God, paradoxical origin of both snakes and the courage that deprives them of their venom, the slavish and apprehensive move upward to their destiny. What is the ultimate exemplar of this motif of exposure to serpent hung on tree? And where does the sheer genius of the ineffable author of the text make itself so clearly manifest? With this detail, which is anything but a detail. Millennia later, in the Gospel of John, Jesus draws a strange comparison between himself and this bronze snake. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have eternal life. John 3:14-15. What is to be made of this most peculiar and unexpected comparison? In what wise could the benevolent Savior be akin to the most terrible and poisonous of serpents? Here is the first of the conceptual tools necessary to solve the mystery of that problem. The miraculous provision and flowing water that God provides to the Israelites and the loaves and fishes that Jesus later provides are meta-foods, as intimated previously. They are emblematic of the heavenly ethos, spirit of psychological integrity and community aim that ensures the promised life more abundant rather than concrete instantiations of food and water themselves. Christ similarly presents himself, the spectacle of his example, more particularly, as a meta-serpent, as the sum, or more accurately, essence or spirit of all the terrible things about human existence that must be looked upon voluntarily, even accepted, gratefully, and welcomed, for the ultimate sacrificial offering most pleasing to God to be fully realized. The spirit of divine calling and conscience, seeking to redeem the lost sheep of Israel, insists on them facing their fears, voluntarily confronting the venomous serpent their faithless cowardice called into being. Are such snakes, however toxic they might be, the sum total or essence of all real and possible evil? Not in the least. The snake in the Garden of Eden is a mere proxy for Lucifer himself. And the terror engendered by the deadly reptiles of the desert wasteland is likewise a mere instantiation of the essence of what is terrifying and deadly. What is the worst possible of all tragic and malevolent outcomes? The most dismal and unfair fate visited on the least deserving individual imaginable. It is for this reason that the Passion of Christ constitutes the definitive redemptive catastrophe, the absolute terror lurking behind all proximal terrors, the pattern of confrontation with mortality and evil as such. It is the cross that is the ultimate dragon, the cross that is the union of the Leviathan of chaos and the behemoth of pathological order that the Logos overcame at the very beginning and continues to defeat always and everywhere. The danger starts right at Christ's birth, lowly as it is, threatened by the powers of the state, forcing the obedience of its subjects, Matthew 2:1, Luke 2:1-7, and then aiming death directly at the Hebrew infants of the time, Matthew 2:16. Jesus confronts Satan himself and his temptations in the wilderness, Matthew 4:1-11, Mark 1:12-13, Luke 4:1-13, and is rejected by his community at Nazareth, Matthew 13:53-58, Mark 6:1-6, Luke 4:16-30. He is made subject to the tender mercies of the religious, academic, and legal hypocrites, the Pharisees, scribes, and lawyers, Matthew 21-23, Mark 12, Luke 20. Jesus is betrayed by his closest compatriot, Judas, Matthew 26:14-16, Mark 14:10-11, Luke 22:3-6, and denied by Peter, the rock on which he founds his church, Matthew 26:69-75, Mark 14:66-72, Luke 22:54-62, John 18:15-27. All that horror, voluntarily accepted, proves insufficient, hard though the going is. He must further experience unjust trial and crucifixion, exposure to the vengeful mob, scourging and sentencing by the foreign tyrant, all of whom know of his fundamental innocence, selection for torture and death instead of a known criminal, and then subjection to a death designed specifically for its humiliating quality and pain. All that while still young and unmarried, and in the presence of the mother who loves him, while he watches her anguish. Matthew 26:57-27:66, Mark 14:53-15:47, Luke 22:54-23:56, John 18:12-19:42. Then, to top it all off, he is called on to harrow hell, which means that he journeys to the very heart of malevolent darkness itself. This is the existential catastrophe we have all been attempting to voluntarily face and contend with, like the poisoned Israelites in the desert, for the 2,000 years of the dominion of Christianity in the West. There is simply no worse and then better fate than that of Christ. We have chosen to place the crucifix, the terrible symbol of all that, at the very center of the central place of our cathedrals and churches, the place where the holy sacrifice that unites psyche and community is eternally offered. We place those tabernacles likewise at the center of our towns, with that cross serving as the staff of tradition and transformation, put firmly in place to mark the ideal and establish the psychological and social order that is good or very good. In this manner, we duplicate the redemptive ritual of exposure that God offered the Israelites in their misery